Had a problem with the idea of 100-million-year-old fossils, and we solved that by understanding that time, in fact, from two different reference planes, has two different durations, even for the identical events. It's measured differently. Today, I'd just like to talk about the likelihood or unlikelihood of all that we have to do being chance, or whether or not there's evidence of design in the universe. There's a whole range of opinions on whether or not it's chance or not. And it's those opinions that I would like to discuss today and see if there is basis for one or the other. An evolving certainty that God cannot exist. Now, that headline didn't appear in a rag newspaper. It's the London Financial Times, certainly one of the 10 leading newspapers in the world. An evolving certainty that God cannot exist, which would mean that people are pretty much wasting their time taking discovery. That's the 27th, 28th of April, 1991. And it's discussing some of the work of Richard Dawkins, who is an extremely compelling, very gifted writer, who presents an atheistic view of the world, pretty obviously, since that's his quote in this article, 3 centimeters high, right across the page. His argument is that everything is by chance, that there's no need to have any design in the world, that nature can do it all by chance. Stephen Gould, full professor at Harvard, paleontologist, biologist. The world is one big crapshoot, one big dice game. We are an accident of nature. Evolution is one big crapshoot, one dice game. There's no evidence of design at all in the world. So that's one extreme range of opinions, and you'll find that many biologists have that. That for some reason or other, there's the feeling that the world can be described totally by chance, that the development of life from the Big Bang through to humans. I actually used to call this my apple pie, because I used to say through the development of apple pies. Can all be described by chance. There's another whole range of opinions which has the exact opposite opinion. Michael Turner, astrophysicist at the University of Chicago. In other words, a heavyweight in the field. To get life out of a Big Bang, the world has to be so finely designed, the laws of nature have to be so finely tuned, that in human terms, this fine tuning of the world to move from a Big Bang through the development of the universe, through to people, humans, and advanced life, would be the same as throwing an imaginary, here's his words, the same as throwing an imaginary microscopic dart across the entire universe to the most distant quasar and hitting a bullseye 1 millimeter in diameter on the other side of the universe. That in human terms is how he sees exactly what Dawkins says, a biologist, says, an evolving certainty that God cannot exist. Evolving certainty because time and again he feels he can demonstrate that the world and all that it contains can best be described by random reactions. You know, the difficulty in trying to decide whether or not it's all random or not is that it's an understood function of God in the world that the laws of nature do a lot of the guiding. As Maimonides points out in his Guide for the Perplexed, the Mori Nevuchim, one of the aspects of angels isn't that they dance on the head of the pin. One of the aspects of angels is the forces of nature doing God's work. So do you see the forces of nature doing God's work? So it can seem as if it's all by chance, or it can seem as if, in fact, there's a great amount of design in the world. I think one of the classes before this must have talked about Jericho and the Battle of Jericho, how archaeologically it's come to match the Book of Joshua. It may have. In any event, you know, the idea would be that now that the ruins of Jericho have been found to match so clearly what the Book of Joshua described, matches entirely. It happened in the spring of the year at harvest time. The Jordan River was in flood. The river backs up. It even talks about in the Book of Joshua that the waters back up, and it mentions not just they split like in the coming out of Egypt, but when the priests were crossing the Jordan, They put their, to come into Jericho, the Battle of Jericho. After the Exodus, they put their foot in the water, and what happens? The river's back up. And you're told that it backs up all the way to the village of Adam, next to Adam. So the geologists have said to us, well, now we understand what happened. It was an earthquake. Now, here's the idea of the forces. So was it an earthquake? It wasn't an earthquake. An earthquake would do the job just right. Jericho's on the Rift Valley. It's a rift that runs from Africa through Asia and on up north. And it passes right a few kilometers over to our east here. So that earthquakes occur regularly where these continental plates are shifting is commonplace. The act of nature damming the Jordan by an earthquake, that would not be something anti-theological. You'd not be a heretical statement. Because as Maimonides says, it's the forces of nature that often act to do the work of God. What would that be? It would be an earthquake at just the right time. And if you've ever taken a bus from Jerusalem and gone to Beit Shan, and the bus goes via Jericho, so the bus then heads north. And if you sit on the right, it heads north along the Jordan River, and if you sit on the right-hand side of the bus going north, then you're on the east side of the bus. And it's like getting a free tour guide for nothing, just the cost of the bus ticket. So you travel all the way along the Jordan River. And you can see that the Jordan cuts a very deep channel through the soft rock. And from time to time, when there are earthquakes, what happens? The Jordan dams up. The walls of these channels it cuts fall in. So an earthquake and stop the river. Well, what does the book of Joshua say? The river was in the flood stage. The book of Joshua didn't have to tell us the river was in the flood stage, but it took the trouble to do so. It was the spring of the year, harvest time. And as you know from the ruins, large amounts of food were found in the ruins of Jericho, which proves that it was harvest time. It's not like today we go to Waldbaum's or Supersol or whatever supermarket you're going to. You get more food. In the times of Joshua, the only time you had a lot of food stores was harvest time. And then you ate down till the next harvest time. So the fact that large amounts of food were found in the ruins tell us that it was harvest time. The fact that it was the flooded river, that the Jordan was in the flood stage, tells us it was the spring of the year. All those things account match now what we find in the tell, in the ruins. What's interesting, though, is what would happen. So you have an earthquake. The walls of the river would collapse. The river would be dammed up, and the Israelites could cross in the dried-up river. Now, that might say, wow, who needs God? Well, the point that Maimonides makes, long before anyone was doing the digging in Jericho, is that these forces of nature, so fortuitously timed, are one of the manifestations of the Creator in the world. And an aftershock would have brought down the walls of Jericho. We know it was a short siege. How do we know it was a short siege? Because the book of Joshua tells us that the Israelites walked around the city, how many days? 6 days. And the seventh day they walked around once, blew their trumpets, everybody shouted, and the walls came tumbling down. We know it was a short siege from the tell, from the ruins in the historical mound. How do we know it was a short siege? Because of all the food that was found. The things that made cities fall in those days was lack of food and lack of water. When you have big walls, lack of water, Jericho is an oasis. It has its own water supply. Lack of food, we found the food burned in the ruins of the city. What made the city fall was the walls came tumbling down. So now we're said, the geologists say, now we've proven that it's all natural. We knew it all along. It was an earthquake. And the earthquake dammed up the river, let the Israelites cross, and the secondary tremor brought down the walls. Is that a problem? It's not a theological problem. It was an earthquake fortuitously timed. It's trying to find out whether it's chance that drives nature, or in fact, is there some hint of design by these chances continuously occurring? I don't think in the previous talk I discussed the splitting of the Sea of Reeds, right? The Exodus. We didn't get into that. No. The classic example of whether trying to decide whether or not it's there's an evolving evidence that God cannot exist, this statement by Dawkins, or in fact, is the universe so finely tuned, like a dart across the universe hitting a bullseye, which is correct? Is it all by chance? I think we can learn this idea of nature, a directed nature, from some of the accounts that are in the Torah itself. The Torah can't go into every account in great depth. It's a pretty short book. So it treats some accounts in detail. And from those details, you can extrapolate to other incidents. One of the ones which I zero in on is the going out of Egypt. I mean, that's treated in in exquisite detail because it's so fundamental to all of Am Yisrael, the people of Israel. I mean, the going out of Egypt, the Exodus is what made us a people. So clearly the Bible spent a lot of time on that. The Israelites go out of Egypt. They head north towards Canaan directly, and they come back and they reverse their journey and they get to the Sea of Reeds, the Yam Suf. The Sea of Reeds. Now they get to the Yam Suf, and the ocean's on one side, or the Sea of the Reeds, the Yam Suf on one side, and the Egyptians are coming on the other side. And they're trapped. The Israelites are trapped. They're between the Egyptians are gonna get them, or the sea is gonna get them. So at this point they had a great choice. They could have made a very important choice. Did they go forward into the sea, or they give up and they go back to Egypt as slaves? They could have chosen to go back to Egypt as slaves, right? It wouldn't have been a problem. There's only Moses standing in their way. And then the Moabites would be giving discovery instead of the Jews. You know, because if we didn't take the Torah, there'd be another tribe that would have taken it. You know, so we lucked out. We took it. The Israelites didn't go back to Egypt. They moved into the water. But what happens is they're against the water. They pray to God. They say, you know, we're trapped. God says, don't pray to me. Why are you praying to me? Move forward into the water. Right? Then there's the statement of the Midrash, the teaching that one of the tribes moved forward and the waters split before them. But the Torah says exactly what happens. What does the Torah talk about? It doesn't talk about something that's obviously supernatural. The Torah could have said, if it really wanted to impress the Egyptians and the Israelites, what should have happened is that the heavens should have split. The clouds should have opened up. A straw should have come down from heaven, and God should have sucked up the Yam Suf, the Sea of Reeds. I mean, that would have really blown everybody's mind. You know, they would have seen it, would know what's going on. The Israelites would have gone first, and the Egyptians would have followed them right on in. The heavens would have opened up again. A straw would have come down from heaven. The spritz from heaven. Now that, I don't know why God didn't do that. You know, I mean, there, if you wanted to make it a dramatic event, seltzer from heaven wipes out the Egyptians. You know, we'd be talking about it for the next 3,000 years, as we've been doing. But we haven't been talking about seltzer from heaven. Instead of the straw coming from heaven and catching the Egyptians with the big spritz, what happened? What does the Torah talk about? It says exactly why the waters split. A wind blew all night. It says that God made a strong wind blow all night. The Mediterranean, the Sea of Reeds, and you have the Red Sea down here. It's a very special geometry. And here you have Egypt, Sinai, and Canaan. So the Israelites went up, came back, and crossed here. And the wind blew. But the Torah gives a lot of detail on this wind. It's interesting. It says the wind blew all night. It even says God made a wind blow all night. I mean, that amazes me. The Torah has so few extra words, essentially no extra words. So why does the Torah waste its time saying, and God made a strong wind blow all night? No, why would it say God made a wind blow all night? What, I think the man in the moon made the wind? They called Yisrael and said, give us a wind. And the meteorologist got on and started pumping the wind up. Why does it say God made a wind, strong wind blow all night? Why? Because the wind looks so natural, you would have mistaken it for a natural wind. How do we know the wind looked exactly natural? Because first the Israelites say, save us, God. Then the water splits and the Israelites go forward into the dried up seabed. But after the Israelites go through, who follows them right on in? Huh? The Egyptians, yeah. Now, had the wind looked supernatural, what wouldn't the Egyptians have done? They wouldn't have followed them. They would have run back to Egypt, right? How do we know that? Because after they're in the dried up seabed and the water's coming back to drown them, they say, Yah Habibi, let's get out of here. God is fighting for the Israelites, right? So as soon as they realize that the wind was unnatural, they try to get out. So the wind looked so natural that we had to be told that nature's doing God's work. How do we know? God made a strong east wind blow all night. That's why it tells us that. Otherwise, we wouldn't have known. It could have been just a strong east wind. Amazing. And it was just a strong east wind at just the right time and happened to have done just the right job. It blew all night and dried up the seabed. What's interesting is that Recently, at the University of Rhode Island and also the University of Florida in Gainesville, a computer study was done on this amazing tale in the Torah, the idea of God, nature doing God's work, splitting the Yam Suf, splitting the Sea of Reeds. And this geometry is quite, this topography and also the whole system here, the aquatic system, is quite special. There are not many places in the world. We have a very long, shallow, fairly shallow, like 10-meter deep sea, going then out into a large ocean, which then empties into the Indian Ocean. So you had a huge reservoir of water down here, up into the Reed Sea. And the computer study was done, it's interesting, was done by a couple of Israelis that were on sabbatical, one, as I mentioned, Rhode Island, one at the University of Florida. And they wanted to see whether this could actually happen, because there's an account, I was told by one of the participants in Discovery last week, of an Englishman who was in this vicinity of the Sea of Reeds about 100 years ago, that he saw the sea actually split. He thought it was a pretty frightening sight, because a strong wind had been blowing all night. What's interesting is two things. If God's making the wind blow so new all night, and if God wants to dry up the river, the ocean, he needs all night to dry it up. Let him blow the wind for 2 seconds and dry it up, the Israelites to go through. Why did God blow the wind blow all night? So these people put in, these scientists put in a 40-knot wind, which is about like, I mean, 45 miles an hour, for 8 hours. Just like the Torah says. A strong wind, not a hurricane, not a tornado, just a simple, average 40-knot wind for 8 hours, blowing across the Sea of Reeds and into the computer program with this geography, with this topology and topography of the water here and the land. And what did it do after 8 hours? What did it show? The sea dried up. Took the whole night and it dried up. You know, I mean, why didn't we get a tornado to blow and just dried up like that? But that wasn't the idea, because it had to look natural. So for 8 hours, the water dried up, just like the Torah says. What bothered me about that, though, of course, is that if it takes 8 hours to dry up, you'd think it would take 8 hours to fill back up also, like the water comes trickling back in. But that clearly is not what happened, because if it took 8 hours to dry up, and then the Israelites went across, so the water would start to come back. The Egyptians would see the water coming back. Ya Habibi, let's head back home. Head west. Right? Back to Egypt. Let's get out of here. They got all 8 hours. It took 8 hours to dry up. You know, so they had 4 hours. Why didn't they get out? Why'd they drown? Because the major impact, I think, of this computer study is the following. That although it took 8 hours for the water to go out, when soon as the wind stopped blowing, the water returns so that it comes back in 4 minutes. The water comes back like a tidal wave, like a wall of water, as is described in the Torah. It took 8 hours to dry it. Why? Because if you look at the geometry of the water here, you see that you have this huge reservoir, the Red Sea and the entire Indian Ocean, to hold this relatively small amount of water. So it wasn't. So as long as the wind was holding it back, it didn't trickle back in. But when you stop the wind, you have this wall of water behind it, pushing it forward as a wall, coming back in. And if you read the description in the Shir Hayam, in the song that the Israelites sing after their Savior, and what happened, they describe what happens to the Egyptians, it's essentially a description of a tidal wave sweeping in and destroying the enemy. Is it all by chance? Yeah, it might be all by chance, but the Torah came and told us God made a strong east wind blow all night. So whether or not there's an evolving certainty that God can not exist based on a few observations of nature, I would question the validity of that statement, that indeed perhaps there is in fact no indication that God cannot exist, especially if you realize, as Maimonides said about 800 years ago, that one of the aspects of God's action in the world is nature doing God's work. Sure, it could be an earthquake that brought down the walls of Jericho and dried up the Jordan. Let it be an earthquake, but an earthquake just at the right time. Roger Penrose, the mathematician, I don't know if there's any mathematicians or any scientists in the group today, they'll know the name, wrote a book recently. He's a mathematician at the University of Oxford, professor of mathematics. He's certainly one of the 10 leading mathematicians in the world. Penrose wrote a book recently, about 2 years ago, called The Emperor's New Mind. In it, and Penrose, as far as I understand from persons who have been in the course that know of him, I've never met him, but we've had persons in the course from Oxford, and if there's anyone from Oxford today, you can say yes or no to what I'm saying. He's a secular scientist. He doesn't evidence any theological bent in his work. He might be a believer or not, but he doesn't. There's no evidence in his work. In The Emperor's New Mind, he devotes about 45 pages, about 10% of the book, to a development of just how likely it is to have gotten our laws of nature by chance. You know, Michael Turner, the physicist, said it was like throwing a dart across the entire universe. Penrose, who did the early work on the mathematics of the Big Bang, he and Hawking developed the understanding of what it takes to make a singularity, the Big Bang, to produce a universe. And he, being intimately associated with this mathematics, developed, and I'm not going to try to go through the math now. First of all, I couldn't do it any longer. I don't know if I could ever do it, but I certainly can't do it these days. But I can read enough to understand what he's saying. He comes out with a statement at the end that the likelihood of getting the universe by chance, our universe, just one of the laws of nature, one of the laws of entropy, which lets you take energy out of work, or let's say work out of energy, is one chance in 10 to the 10th to the 123rd. One chance in 10 to the 10th to the 123rd. That's what Penrose says is the likelihood of getting the law, one of the laws of nature. Then he goes on and says, and that's only one of the laws of nature, not to count the amazing balance of gravity, of the nuclear forces, all these things that just are like on a knife edge to give us life. But at this point, when he says the likelihood of getting the law of entropy that would allow us to get energy, he says that at this point, it's clear to him, to Penrose, that an intelligent creator must have chosen the laws of nature. That while probability never says never, all of science is based on the highly unlikely never happening, and the very, very highly unlikely, like a number like this, is impossible. He therefore says it's clear to him that an intelligent creator must have chosen the laws of nature. He doesn't mention God. He doesn't say there's a God active in history. He doesn't say, now, praise God, I'm a believer. Nothing. There's no mention of God in the whole book. That's the end of it, there, after 45 pages of math. But he did put that in writing. And at that point, he's willing to say that you can't get our laws by chance. Stephen Hawking, in A Brief History of Time, wanted to show just the opposite, that while getting the universe by chance is not obvious that it'll happen, still it's not without precedent. And he says, about a third or halfway through the book, he says, our universe by chance is a bit like, well, it's a bit like writing a sonnet. And I read it exactly. I have it in the appendix of Genesis of the Big Bang. Here it is. He says, the likelihood of getting the universe by chance is a little bit like it. It's page 185. I see someone looking through the. It's a bit like the well-known hordes of monkeys hammering away on typewriters. Most of what they write will be garbage, but very occasionally, by pure chance, they will type out one of Shakespeare's sonnets. Getting our universe, a world with these laws of nature, is a bit like the well-known hordes of monkeys hammering away on typewriters. Most of what they write will be garbage, but very occasionally, by pure chance, they will type out one of Shakespeare's sonnets. So if Hawkins is going to tell me, why shouldn't I, that this is the likelihood of getting the universe, you know, why shouldn't I believe him? You know, I mean, he's a guy that has sold more books on physics than anyone else ever. What's the likelihood of getting a sonnet by chance? Because he says qualitatively, like Michael Turner says, the dart across the universe, qualitatively, Penrose gives an actual number. Hawkins gives a qualitative statement, like hammering out a sonnet by chance. Anyone know any of the Shakespeare sonnets? I happen to have only known one when I decided. I went through and calculated what the likelihood is by chance. Anyone know even the opening line of any sonnet by Shakespeare? Huh? Okay, that's one I never even heard of. But all the sonnet, the one I knew was, "Shall I compare thee to a summer's day?" Okay? Shaking. Yeah, that's the only one I knew, and I looked it up in that massive book called Shakespeare, The Complete Works. And like all sonnets, it has 14 lines. What's the likelihood of getting a Shakespeare sonnet by chance? Shall I get the sonnet number 18? They're all about the same length in the number of letters. It's like that sonnet has... The sonnet has 488 letters. So essentially saying, what's the likelihood of typing out 488 letters, giving a sequence that'll match it, that will spell it, forgetting word breaks and periods and punctuations, just some 488 letters in sequence that will spell out the words of the sonnet. Because Hawkins has told me that's how likely it is to get our universe. I'm not going to question him. I mean, you know, 100 weeks on the bestseller list, he must know what he's talking about. Supposing we have a variation of 9 characters, 10 characters, 0 to 9, and we'll pretend they're letters instead. I want to pull out any one particular of these characters, like a 3. I reach into the bag and I want to pull out a 3. What's my chances of pulling out a 3? 1 in 10. Yeah, 1 in 10. Way of writing 10 is 10 to the 1. It's a 1 with 1 0 after. Supposing I have 0 to 99. I want to get a 25 or a 46, you know, any like an is, is, any particular. What's one chance in what? I want to get these two numbers in sequence. 49. Yeah, 10 squared, exactly, which is one chance in 100. And if there were 1,000? Huh? 10 cubed, with 1 with 3 zeros. And if there were 488, it'd be 10 to the what? 10 to the? What? 48. Yeah, because notice that 10 always stays the same with each cipher. But the number here changes with the number of ciphers. Look at that, 10 to the 488th. Of course, in letters, we don't have 10 variations in each column. How many do we have? So it shouldn't be 10 to the 48th, it should be what? Yeah, the likelihood is of getting a sonnet is 26. Is 26 to the 488th, or in units of 10, 10 to the 690th. Well, okay, if that's the likelihood of getting the world by chance, it's kind of interesting. It's not very likely. Anyone have an estimate of how many seconds there have been since the beginning of time? Since the Big Bang, how many seconds there have been? 10 to the what? What would you say? 10 to the... just a guess. Yeah. There have been, since the beginning of time, there have been approximately 10 to the 18th seconds. Since the beginning of time, there have been about 10 to the 18th seconds in the 15 billion years. The mass of the universe is about 10 to the 56 grams. Do you notice the difference in the scale of these numbers versus the 10 to the 690th? The reality is that if you took the Earth and hung it by a string to whatever would be holding the string, you put a light bulb out there to keep us warm, and took the entire universe and converted all the universe into into computers of microchips, you know, 1 milligram per chip, and we took all the forms of life, not just the monkeys hammering away, but from bacteria and algae up through people and donkeys and even from the dandelions as well, the plants. And we teach every form of life to make 488 tries a second. And we have all these microchips. The entire universe is turned into computers. There's not enough time since the beginning of time to get a single sonnet by chance. And yet we're told that the universe might be all by chance, and this is the likelihood. Well, if this is the likelihood, then what Hawkins is really telling us is that we didn't get the universe by chance. Because all of physics says the very highly unlikely never happens by chance. That's the basis, without exception, of physics. We'll never get a sonnet by chance, and quite likely we may never be able to get a universe by chance. Of course, we're talking about the laws of nature that would produce the world. If the universe were, there's an idea of the world that the universe might have had many, many Big Bangs. You know, that a Big Bang, the universe expands, and then if there's enough matter in the world to make the universe collapse, because the universe flies apart from the explosion and the gravity of the stars flying out in one direction, pull on the gravity of the stars on the other direction, and gradually the outward flow slows, and the universe will be pulled back together. And then it'll be like a big implosion, a crunch, and then another explosion. It's called the oscillating universe, going on forever. So one of the arguments is that, in fact, there's been a lot of big bangs. So it's not, so even though this is unlikely, if the universe has been undergoing oscillations forever, infinite number of oscillations, you know, so our laws of nature are special, but big deal. We'll get them by chance. Or erase them. We'll get it by chance just by having many, many oscillations. It's called the oscillating universe. The difficulty is that there are no data which support an oscillating universe. All of the measurements that we have of the universe, without any exception, and there are many, many measurements, show that the nature of the universe, the mass of the universe, the rate of expansion of the universe is such that the expansion will never stop, that there has been only one big bang and it will never stop. That's without any exception, that the amount of stuff in the universe is not sufficient to stop the expansion. And there are a whole range of data which confirm this. The argument against it is that other scientists that don't want to see a beginning or want to see an oscillating universe say that, yeah, sure, we can't see the matter, but there may be dark matter, invisible matter, brown matter, gray matter, and all that may be enough to close the universe. It's a question of how much stuff there is. Because if there's a lot of stuff on one side of the universe and the gravity of it pulls on the other side, it would be enough to close the universe. All the measurements of everything we can see show there's not enough. But people say maybe there's invisible matter. And there may be enough invisible matter to close the universe. And that argument was one of the great white hopes until about the last year and a half. And now that argument has evaporated also. Because even if there's enough matter, in theory, to shrink to close the universe, it doesn't matter. Because the laws of physics that govern the relationship of particles in the world, primarily the laws of entropy, show that the laws of nature cannot sustain an oscillating universe. That's what's important. That even if the universe would collapse again, the laws of nature cannot sustain a universe which will undergo many oscillations. And I'll get off this topic after just reading this one thing. Steven Weinberg, in the closing pages of his extraordinarily good book, The First 3 Minutes, I cannot recommend this book highly enough. It's certainly the best description of the early universe ever written. Anyone that works in the field, and I'm not referring to myself because I just barely touched the field, but anyone that works in the field says read The First 3 Minutes by Steven Weinberg, Basic Books. It was published in 1977. It's all the data are still fine. He makes one interesting assumption, though, that there's enough matter to close the universe, to make it shrink. And then on the last page of his book, he deals with the idea of an oscillating universe. And in essence, it ties the whole argument together. So, here are his words. Some cosmologists are philosophically attracted to the oscillating model of the universe because it nicely avoids the problem of Genesis. How does it avoid the problem of Genesis? There's no beginning, right? It's oscillating forever, so there's no beginning. No beginning, aha, no beginner. What a look. That's what the atheist says. Thank God, no beginning. Some cosmologists are philosophically attracted to the oscillating model of the universe because it nicely avoids the problem of Genesis. The oscillating model of the universe does, however, face one severe theoretical difficulty. In each cycle, because of the law of nature of increasing energy in every expansion, the number of photons, that's the particles of energy, like the stuff coming out of the light bulb, the stuff coming out of the sun, they're called photons. Particles of energy are called photons. The number of photons will increase, and the number of particles, solid universe, will decrease. So he says that if we've undergone a large number of oscillations, or an infinite number without any beginning, then the universe would consist entirely of photons and no solid particles. Right now the ratio of photons to particles is large, but not infinite, because we have a solid universe also. And then he says, so it is hard to see how the universe could have previously experienced an infinite number of cycles. There must have been a beginning. Now, Stephen Weinberg wrote that in 1977. I wrote to him about a year ago, and I got an answer after several months. It's a very short question. I just asked him, do you still accept the argument that you had in the closing pages of your book? And Weinberg wrote back a short letter saying, not only does the argument of entropy is still valid. But now there are stronger proofs that the universe could not have had an infinite number of cycles, that there must have been a beginning. The point is, there was a time before which there was no universe. There was a time before which the universe didn't exist. That's something that acceptance by the physics community is only in the last 2 years. The understanding that time, space, and matter were created with the Big Bang, as we said last week, the Bible always talked about it. Physics about 15 years ago with the work of Roger Penrose, the man I was quoting before, and Stephen Hawking demonstrated that the Big Bang produced time, space, and matter. But when Hawking wrote his book and his famous Brief History of Time, it was 100 weeks on the bestseller list, people hadn't yet considered clearly enough entropy. And so Hawking develops a picture for the last two-thirds of his book which shows a universe that's oscillating forever. It's a time-space continuum. That's no longer accepted as valid. Luckily, the royalties are already in, so it doesn't really matter, relative to Hawking. But the fact is that entire argument, which is the entire premise of the book, that's what it's titled, A Brief History of Time, is invalid. There was a time before which time did not exist. In fact, the truth is, the title is a good one, A Brief History of Time, because time has a history which has a beginning. And that beginning appears to be about 10 to the 18th seconds ago, which is a lot of time. It's 15 billion years, 15,000 million years. But the idea that a universe may oscillate forever is invalid by the laws of physics. It doesn't matter how much dark matter is eventually found. You can't have an oscillating universe and still have a universe with life in it. I belabor the point because we now see that physics has made the major shift it can possibly make ever to the theological understanding of the universe. There was a beginning. And if you haven't noticed it, that happens to be the first line in the Bible. They may leave out that it was God that did the work, but the majority of physicists now hold that in the beginning, there was a beginning. A Big Bang. An extraordinary shift. A shift that nothing else matches it. Nothing else can ever match it. That's it. There was a beginning. Remember, it was only Einstein, the turn of the century, that said the universe is eternal, and then changed his mind, realizing that was a major blunder on his part. And it was only in the 1940s and the 1950s that even the basic model of the Big Bang became accepted. So we now have a major shift towards Torah. There was a beginning. If you move along a timeline from the Big Bang 15 billion years ago, so we had to get out of the Big Bang, and all you have is energy and particles. I'm not going to belabor the whole development here of how the elements were made. The extraordinary fact is the Big Bang doesn't make the elements. It makes the raw materials for the elements, but they were made later in stars. Physics asks for a one-time force right after the beginning. We almost never ask for one-time forces. That was Einstein's mistake when he put the subjective force in his cosmological equation to show a static universe. You may remember we talked about that in error. Physics does ask for a one-time force right here at the beginning to have the expansion that will fine-tune the universe. It's what Michael Turner talked about, the fine-tuning. It's called inflation. And that happens immediately, but absolutely immediately after the beginning. The universe is a turmoil. The universe suddenly inflates. Whether it's inflation with a capital I, meaning the actual theory, or some phenomena, just relabeling it as inflation because no one's really certain what happened at that time, something extraordinary happens right at the beginning. One time. What I find is amazing is that the Torah, at the very beginning, Genesis chapter 1, verse 2, gives us the only one-time force it includes in the book. The creations, of course, the major one-time force was in the beginning. God created the heavens and the earth. And the major one-time force is the quantum effect that pops the universe into existence. But following that, the quantum fluctuation, you have a one-time force to expand the universe out. Without that, no life, no universe with life. Genesis chapter 1, verse 2. The first verse is Genesis 1:1 is the global statement. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Genesis chapter 1, verse 2. The Spirit of God hovered on the face of the universe. Ruach Elohim rechefet al pnei amayim. That statement, the Spirit of God hovers, this interaction, is a one-time phenomena. It occurs nowhere else in the Torah. The Spirit of God, Ruach Elohim, is used only two or three places to discuss how God is shaping the universe. It's one of the things that Bezalel, the person who built the temple, was given. And the temple is supposed to be a reflection of the universe. And Bezalel was given the Spirit of God. But the Spirit of God hovering is a one-time force. Genesis chapter 1, verse 2. Why the Torah talks about it, I have no idea. But we know that it was a one-time force required to zoom the universe out into existence. It happens only once. In all of history, that's it. It doesn't repeat itself. Physics never, ever calls for these things because it's like fudging the data. You know, if you want to get your answer, you say, well, we have this one time, you know, we can't observe it now. But physics, it's not fudging the data for physics because it realizes something special had to happen to tune the universe for life. We see it happening right in the words of the Torah. Look, we move along now the timeline, we get to the formation of the elements and the stars, and finally we get to the solar system. Solar system forms about 4.8 billion years ago. Now we start getting decimal points in the numbers because we can have like radioactive dating of rocks from meteors, etc. Everything is molten, the Earth is completely molten from the energy of all the particles falling together. And about 3.8 billion years ago, these were on billions of years, water appears on the Earth. Liquid water appears for the first time 3.8 billion years ago. For those that haven't read the popular theories on how the Earth forms, we are at one time in this region of the universe, there was dust, stardust. The elements of life that we have were made in exploding stars. The Big Bang produced hydrogen and helium, the two lightest of elements, and a smidgen of lithium. But we're made of carbon and nitrogen and iron, all these heavier elements. And they weren't made in the Big Bang. They were made from the original stuff in stars that exploded. And in this region of the universe, here where we are right now, and every other place where there's a star, what appears to have happened is dust, the residue from bygone stars that have exploded with their elements, pulled together and formed the sun and the planets. It drew together by gravity, pulling it together. When the forces in the center became high enough, the star ignited. We call it the sun. But what the essence is that at one time, our bodies were, in the fullest sense of the word, stardust. And I mean that we are literally made of the residue of stars that exploded. The elements of our body cannot have come originally from the Big Bang because we have too much of iron, too much of carbon, nitrogen. Stars, in the cores of stars that exploded, these heavier elements were made. And they were recycled. And we are, you talk about recycling as nothing new, apparently. And we are the recycled debris of bygone supernovas, bygone stellar explosions. That's the solar system. About 4.8 billion years ago, 3.8 billion years ago, water appears on the Earth. All of Earth's life is based on water. There are speculations that perhaps out on some planet around Jupiter or Saturn, there may be life based on ammonia. But on the Earth, it's unequivocal. All life is water-based. No water, no life. Yes, water. Yes, the possibility of life. So it's here and here further that life could have come to exist after water appears on the Earth. That's a long time, 3.8 billion years. So clearly life could have started by chance. That's the whole argument of an evolving certainty that God cannot exist. 3.8 billion years ago, water forms, and now you have the raw materials for life. And we move along the timeline towards the complexity that we see in human life. The question was, how could life start? Can we show it that it was in by chance? In 1953, Stanley Miller did an experiment which rocked the understanding of man's place in the universe. He, in essence, demonstrated that life could start by chance, that there was no need for a creator. It was the news the scientific community had been waiting for. Stanley Miller, a graduate student at the University of Chicago, took a flask, evacuated it, filled it with the gases that were thought to have been present in the primordial atmosphere, methane, ammonia, nitrogen, water vapor, and zapped it, attached it to it, put some electrodes in the flask, sealed it up, and zapped, made sparks, zap through the flask. Zap, zap. Why sparks? Because they simulated lightning. Lightning is very common in the atmosphere. Even today, there's thousands of bolts. We don't see them all the time, but they're going. Lightning is very prevalent in the atmosphere. So what you had in the atmosphere was several special types of gases and lots of lightning. Lightning gave the energy. What would it produce? After 2 days, anyone know the experiment? It's a pretty famous experiment. What he got out, what Stanley Miller got out of the flask after just 2 days? Huh? Yeah, amino acids. Stanley Miller had proven what the world had been waiting for. After just 2 or 3 days of zapping this flask, amino acids lined the walls of the flask. Why were amino acids so important? Yeah, building blocks of protein. Amino acids are nothing like protein, but he put a few hundred of them together in the right configuration to become proteins. I mean, they're not, you know, they're far from being protein, but they are the building blocks of protein. And proteins are the building blocks of life. This was it. Stanley Miller, after 2 days, you can get amino acids. Yeah, baby. That means, you know, you got 3.8 billion years to go through here to make life. This is it. And it was very big news. I mean, really big news. 1953. Not to miss this extraordinary opportunity, Scientific American didn't commission Stanley Miller because he was still just a student and the world might not listen to him. So they commissioned George Wald, full professor at Harvard University, became a Nobel Prize winner for discovering the role of vitamin A in vision. George Wald, in August 1954, Scientific American, the leading science journal in the world, was asked to publish, it's a commissioned article, certainly reviewed, asked to publish an article on the origins of life, which, being an original fellow, he called The Origin of Life. George Wald was not going to be caught short on this extraordinary opportunity to discuss Stanley Miller's experiment. In fact, that's why he was commissioned at the time. You know, it wasn't by chance that it was now, because it's as quickly as they get into a print, a major review article on the origins of life. And Stanley Miller had laid the foundation of how life could have started. A couple of pages into his article, George Wald gets to the crux of his matter, what Stanley Miller had shown. Life had started by chance. And what he writes is, I think, pure poetry. The important point is that since the origin of life belongs in the category of an at least one-time phenomena, time is on its side. Listen to this now. It's beautiful. Time is, in fact, the hero of the plot. The time with which we have to deal is in the order of 2 billion years. What we regard as impossible on the basis of human experience is meaningless here. Given so much time, the impossible becomes the possible probable, and the probable virtually certain. One has only to wait. Time itself performs the miracles. If you wanted a statement that was like agnosticism put to verse, this would be it. I mean, I can picture, if you've ever done any writing, you know, it's like, you work all day trying to get the right phrase. I mean, I can picture, and I can picture Stanley Miller. It might have been like 2 a.m. He probably got on the phone, he says, Larry, calls up his wife, honey, listen to this beautiful verse I just wrote. It is gorgeous, listen to it. What we regard as impossible on the basis of human experience is meaningless here. We have billions of years. Given so much time, the impossible becomes the possible. The possible probable, and the probable virtually certain. One has only to wait. Time itself performs the miracles. What's the miracle? The miracle of starting of life. 1954, George Wald. In 1979, something extraordinary happened in the scientific community. Not extraordinary that it was earth-shaking, not like Stanley Miller's experiment, but extraordinary in the fact that it was, to the best of my knowledge, unique. Although it may not have been, but as far as I know. Often when a scientist makes an error, an oversight in a piece of work that he's published, so he publishes a few years later, says, I now have a new piece of instrumentation. I mean, it's happened to me. We get a new, better mass spectrometer, or I look at a piece of data, and I now realize I have to modify my conclusions. and then you reprint it, essentially, you know, modified conclusions. But that's not what happened relative to George Wald's article. What happened relative to George Wald's article is Scientific American reprinted it in its entirety, including the quaint woodcuts which he had to include in his article from a Bible which showed how silly the 6 days of creation were. You know, God doing this, isn't it? They reprinted his entire article with the woodcuts, with the retraction. I have never seen a major journal retract an author's work without the author doing the retraction himself. Although stimulating, this article probably represents one of the very few times in his professional life when Wald has been wrong. Examine his main thesis and see, can we really perform a biological cell by waiting for chance combinations of organic compounds? Harold Morowitz, in his book, Energy Flow and Biology, computed that merely to create a bacterium would require more time than the universe might ever see if chance combinations of its molecules were the only driving force. Life could not have started by chance. Since 1979, no major scientific journal, without exception, accepts Origin of Life articles based on the premise that life started by chance. Life is no longer thought to have started by chance. It doesn't mean that, hallelujah, God exists. That's not what they're talking about. But it does mean that you have to have some organizing force, some mineral, something exotic, some catalyst to make it do the work. Now, that doesn't prove God. But what happened when George Wald wrote the article talking about life starting by chance, there was no protest saying, oh, it couldn't happen. No one protested. Everyone accepted it. Suddenly, biologists have had to make the tremendous retreat that, well, we didn't really mean by chance. You know, we always knew there was something that had to guide it. Bubba Mises. There was no protest. Everyone assumed by chance. In 1954, the assumption was, take Stanley Miller's amino acids, put them in a Waring blender or a Cuisinart or whatever, run them for a long enough time, get 100,000 flasks, pour them into each flask, and eventually a bacterium will pop out. In 1979, based on the work of statistics, that's what's important. See, Wald was a great biologist, but limited in his mathematical ability. He had failed to look at the probability of atoms joining together to form amino acids, joining together to form a reproducing molecule. Life could not have started by chance. It does not prove there's a God. One of the arguments that now used is, but it's new since the idea that it's been understood it can't be by chance is why? Well, because maybe something like clay could do the job. Clay is a highly charged mineral, and if you look at it under a microscope, it has plus minus on these many layers. So these now could act as organizing forces. They might be able to pull some kind of molecule like this out, and line one up here. The molecules line up, they join together just right, and life would form. And clay happens to be one of the minerals that is seriously under consideration that might have done the job. Now, see, no longer is it by chance. It doesn't prove there's a God, understand, because something like this might have done the job. But now suddenly, there's been a major retreat from the Waring blender approach to the origin of life to some kind of catalyst making life appear. Clay, in fact, is at the moment the only mineral that has any really strong backing behind it, as you can read in Richard Dawkins' book, The Blind Watchmaker. The difficulty with clay being the force that formed life is life predates clay on the earth. The oldest life forms come at a time when there was little or almost no clay on Earth. So why there are millions of dollars or how much is being spent on research on clay, I really can't understand. It's like one of these alleys. Even if you can get it to do it, the best way of saying it is that at the time that life appears, there's no significant amount of clay on the Earth. So you'd have to make the reaction just work perfectly. Because you need something that could be working in a mass of these natural test tubes to make it happen like this, because it has many, many false starts. Why did Scientific American withdraw the article? Lest you think that since 1979 they've changed their minds, here's a quote from Scientific American, February 1991, page 102. It's on the right-hand column. Page 102, February 1991, Scientific American. Some scientists have argued that given enough time, Even miraculous events. You notice there's a sudden change of tone here now. No longer does time perform the miracle. Even miraculous events become possible, such as the spontaneous emergence of a single-celled organism from random couplings of chemicals. Such an occurrence, the spontaneous occurrence of a bacterium, is about as likely as the assemblage of a 747 by a tornado whirling through a junkyard. The statistical probability of life forming by chance is about the same as forming a 747. It does not prove there's a God. That's not the point I'm up here for. I'm just showing that we've backed very strongly in science to the away from everything by chance. Does it prove there's design? Did God make the wind blow? Was it a strong east wind? Or was it that God made the strong east wind blow? We can never tell that unless we're told. The Egyptians thought it was just a good old strong east wind. They learned, unfortunately, shortly thereafter that it wasn't. Francis, that's 1991. Lest you think there have been some changes. How's this? February 1992, page 17. Francis Crick. Anybody know who Francis Crick was? Yeah, what? What did he do? What work did he do? Francis Crick. Rick, yeah, exactly. DNA. Interestingly, when did he do his work? What year did he do his work in? 1953. Notice a similarity here? 1953. Crick, DNA. The shape of DNA, what makes you tick and mosquitoes tick, and even Saddam Hussein, I'm told, has DNA in his body. 1953, Francis Crick, Watson and Maurice Wilkins did the work for which they eventually shared the Nobel Prize several years later for discovering the shape and the functioning of DNA. Here's what is written in Scientific American, February 1992. I quote Crick because if there's a man who understands the complexity of life, it's Francis Crick. That's how he made his name. Francis Crick insists that given the weakness of all theories of terrestrial genesis, origins of life on Earth, terrestrial genesis, directed panspermia, the directed planting of life on Earth, should still be considered a serious possibility. Francis Crick, the man that discovered how complex life is, says that all of the theories for how life could start are so weak that we should still consider as a serious possibility the planting of life on Earth. Not just the planting, but the directed planting of life. Now, whether you think that he's saying this is a theological bent, you should understand that about 12 lines before this quote, in this same article, Francis Crick avows or states that he's an agnostic that leans towards atheism. See, he's not talking about God doing the planting. He's just saying that life was planted, huh? He's just saying that life. That why did Scientific American withdraw the article? Why this article by Wald? Why has poor Stanley Miller been zapping flasks for the last 39 years and hasn't gotten beyond it? Because he's still zapping flasks. A nice Jewish boy zapping flasks. Why doesn't life? What's the problem with life? Why is Scientific American willing to say that you can't get life by chance? Why would Crick say life may have been planted on Earth? What's the problem? Water appears on the Earth 3.8 billion years ago. George Wald said, we've got a couple of billion years to have life going on. Let it all be the Waring blender approach to life. You know, just random reactions. When does life appear on Earth? What are the oldest fossils on Earth? Anybody know how old they are? It can't happen before 3.8 billion years ago. How old are the oldest fossils? Just about this age right here. Life appears on Earth immediately after the appearance of water. The safest way of saying it is the following. Among the oldest rocks that can bear fossils, namely sedimentary rocks, already are found the fossils of life. Not of people, not of motor cars, but of algae and bacteria, which of course is what we expect, simple life going away. Life appears immediately on the Earth, immediately. Among the oldest fossils in sedimentary rocks, life appears on Earth. That doesn't prove anything except the extreme unlikeliness that it all happened by chance. But I think, in fact, someone will eventually find a mineral, because the Torah doesn't say God created life, does it? No word of creation used for that day. When life appears on the third day, when life appears, that's what it says, and life appears in the Torah, it says, and the earth brought forth life. And I've talked about this with Rabbi Weinberg, Noach Weinberg, and also Yaakov Weinberg. It would appear that the Torah was saying that there are some forces in the earth that favor the formation of life. And again, it won't be any proof that there's God. Just the amazing thing, it was an earthquake just at the right time when those walls came tumbling down. Even the Jordan River dried up, just an earthquake. It's all by chance, or perhaps it's just fortuitous. But the fact that the Torah says that the earth brought forth life comes to tell me that there's something going on in the earth which allows life to form. The waters and the earth separate on the third day. This day here, 3.8 billion years ago, would correspond to the biblical day of about the third day. This would be the formation of the earth and the solar system. The third day of Genesis. And when does life appear on the earth? In other words, is it surprising from a Torah point of view that the earth appears, liquid water appears, and then life appears like in a lockstep, one right after the other? Is that surprising from the Torah point of view? When does life appear on the earth? Which day? The third day. The same day that water appears on life, on the earth, life appears on the earth. From the Torah point of view, there's no big news that life appears right away. We expected it all along. The same day, not an extra day, not even many sentences between water appearing and life appearing. Earth forth life. You know, I find it interesting that George Wald, professor at Harvard, was the one that published the article on the origin of life, and in parallel, the scientist that did the work that led to Scientific American eventually retracting Wald's article was also a Harvard professor. Elsa Barshun did the work that found these early fossils, which essentially made Wald's position untenable. Statistics wouldn't have been enough, I don't think, to make Scientific American withdraw the article, although Scientific American blames it on statistics. The fact that life appears immediately is what makes Wall's article just impossible. It can't have chance. You can't have time performing the miracles when there's not enough time for those miracles to occur. We then move along the timeline from life, and we find that the fossil record looks something like a straight line in which you have only single-celled animals or plants with one cell. For 80% of the time that life was on Earth, life never progressed beyond being one-celled in size. That's it. And at that point, suddenly, when we get about 560 million years ago, suddenly there are major changes. So rapid is the development of life on Earth that the paleontologists who deal with this, here's an article from the New York Times, 23rd of April, 1991, which is interesting because this article here is from the 27th of April, 1991, an evolving certainty that God can't exist. That's the London Financial Times. The New York Times says the same week, spectacular fossils record an early riot of development. No, that's not what it says. Spectacular fossils record early riot of evolution. Spectacular fossils record early riot of creation. You notice that there's subtle changes going into the editorial policy of newspapers, like they're covering their bets. Why do they call it an early riot of creation? As the paleontologist handling these data says that the development of life here in these early years looks more like revolution than evolution. He goes on to say that you'd have to have a new species every 1,000 years. Well, if there are any mathematicians in the audience who ever are confronted with this idea, a new species every 1,000 years, just go through the statistical likelihood of getting a new species every 1,000 years. In my opinion, they might better have said here in the Times, in evolving certainty, that God can exist than that God cannot exist. Because, in fact, point after point shows the changes are so rapid and so dramatic that there's no easy way of describing them. Now, originally, everyone had held by Darwin's theory that evolution should look like this, that the fossil record should look smooth, start with simple life, and become complex in a gradual change, point by point, a gradual change. Darwin had good reason to think this, because when Darwin wrote his book, Origin of Species, the fossil record was scarce. There were fossils around, but not many. And it showed simple fossils were the oldest and the deepest. So you had like a point on each plateau. Darwin, of course, assumed, as he says in his books, if you find that the flow is smooth, my theory will have been proven. He talks about this in the Origin of Theses. So he expected to see fossils to be found like this. That's what was expected to be seen, but that's not what was found. The fossil record now is 100 times, let's say put it 20 years ago when I last dealt with any of these fossils, these data. 20 years ago, the fossil record was about 100 times more extensive than Darwin's time, and the data looked like this. That's the problem. We have these spaces here. What leads from one to the other? These circles, these leaps. You know, the time we're talking about here is 20s or 30s or thousands of years, so it's not like instantaneous, but what's lacking, what the fossil record looks like is a morphology, a body type appears, maintains its self for its duration, disappears, and is replaced by a more complicated one. The difficulty is, even the most recent issue of Scientific American talks about the difficulty of how you can make these changes when you have a large population base. You can't make fast changes like that. It doesn't work statistically or genetically, you know, because we're looking for random mutations that make these changes. Of course, the Torah expected a stepwise layer of development. Why? Because it says, and one God said this, and then the earth brought forth life, and then God says this. These God says are the punctuations, the inputs that make these changes. It doesn't mean we're ever going to find fingerprints of God, you know, on the genetic material. But it does mean that the fossil record today is certainly a burden and not a help towards proving random evolution. It just doesn't prove it. It's in my opinion, not a theological outrage, but a scientific outrage, as many atheistic biologists point out, including Stephen Gould, who is an avowed atheist and an avowed believer in evolution. It's outrageous, he says in one of his writings, that, I paraphrase him, that biological textbooks present evolution as a proven fact, when in fact it's theory, but more than theory, it's theory for which it's very hard to understand how the fossil record works. Niels Eldridge says that it appears to be a theory that's promulgated by a few prominent scientists and accepted because it organizes the data like nicely. But remember, the Torah talks about it also. First you get plant life, then you get aquatic life, then you get the creepy crawlies, then you get land animal life, and then you get humans. The Torah doesn't go into every detail. It only mentions one animal in any way other than generically. What's the one animal that mentioned? The humans. Every other animal is never mentioned in a generic term, you know, is an overall statement. So the Torah doesn't get into these details. This is what we have from the fossil record. It's highly unlikely. The flow is erratic, but the flow, the entire passage is one from tohu and vohu, from disorder and chaotic conditions to orderly life. The subtle point in the Torah is that this also is discussed, the flow from complex to simple. It's one of those golden apples, one of the golden apples that are in the Torah. At the end of each day, it says, and there was evening and there was morning, right? It was first day. No, it wasn't first day, right? There was evening and morning, day one. And there was evening and morning, a second day. Evening and morning, a third day. Evening and morning, a fourth day. What's this evening and morning? First of all, in human experience, does anyone see that a day starts in the evening? Anyone jumps into bed and about to fall asleep and say, oh, the beginning of a new day, and falls asleep? Not very likely, right? Sure, the holidays begin in the evening, but that's like all an artifact of the same influence here. What's the Torah telling us? What's the subtlety of there's evening and there is morning? Erev and Boker, the Hebrew word for evening is Erev. The Hebrew word for morning is boker. V'yehi erev, v'yehi boker. There was evening and there was morning. We say erev means evening, but the root of the words has the golden apple, as Nachmanides points out. What's the root of erev? Like an eruv? What does an eruv do around a city, this wire you draw around a city? Yeah, that's what it does. It's a wire around the city. What does it do? What's the halachic implication, the law, the implication? Huh? That makes a boundary, but why? What's everybody inside? It's all your home. You're all one big happy family mixed together. The root of the word erev is mixture, chaotic. The root of the word boker, morning, is able to be discerned, orderly. In the subtle language of evening and morning, or better, erev and boker, hundreds of years, centuries before the Greeks ever chiseled out the words chaos and cosmos, because Hebrew predates Greeks by Greek by centuries. In that subtle language of evening and morning, the Torah was telling us of a flow upstream from chaos to cosmos, from disorder to order, or from evening to morning. See, it might have said morning, there was morning and there was evening, and then we would all, you know, had no problem. Human-wise, it would have been just right, but we would have missed the golden apple, the deep message, that those days are blocks of a flow, step by step, from disorder to order. And if you read the translation of the Hebrew into the Aramaic, called the Unculus Translation, is the major translation of the Bible. It's done about 2,000 years ago. It's called the translation. You know, your brother's saying, Unculus. As he goes through these days, at each place where he's discussing, where God says it was good, Unculus translates into the Aramaic, and it was good as it was good. Why not? That's the Hebrew. When he gets to the last day, day 6, it's said twice, right? The beginning says God saw it was good, and it was good. But then at the very end, it says, and God saw all that he had done, and it was very good. Tov ma'od. The grammar is identical in those phrases, but there's an adverb added. Very. Very good. There's no reason to change the translation into Aramaic, but Unculus does. Unculus doesn't translate, and it was very good, as, and it was very good into the Aramaic. He says, and the world had become tikkan l'chada, which means either, and it was very orderly, or, and the world had become a unified order. Order is how he translates good in the end. The world had become a unified order. If Unculus realized that this flow from the beginning to what we have mankind wasn't a flow from a few bananas and a monkey, to a bunch of bananas, an orange, a monkey, and a kangaroo. It wasn't a change in quantity of 10 stars to a million stars or a billion stars. It wasn't a quantitative change. A qualitative change had occurred on the sixth day. A universe with disorder had become a universe within where one part had order imprinted on it, an order so deep that it was now mankind working with God to perfect the world. That's essentially what I have to say. There's no proof here of one way or the other. I don't think you can ever get out a demonstration that there's a God. But in fact, what you can see is a flow from a beginning where we now understand that there was a beginning through to life, where life can no longer be seen as starting as chance, through a fossil record that looks stepwise, and great extremes have to be gone in the biological community to understand how it can happen. It's called genetic bottlenecks have to occur, major diseases or separation of animals to make these steps. Sure, you can still explain it as all being natural. That's not a problem. The wind was natural also. You didn't see God up there with the grid, you know, one of these big fans. Oh, here comes the fan from heaven, or a straw coming out of the sky. It was a strong east wind. It was so natural that the Torah had to tell us. And God made a strong east wind blow. So Hannah asks me, okay, Abba, you got the millions of years for the dinosaur bones by relativity. So if dinosaurs are such a big deal, why doesn't the Torah talk about dinosaurs? Does the Torah talk about dinosaurs? See it anywhere in there? Yeah, it's in there. Just a translation. This is it, time and again. If you look on chapter 1, verse 21, and it usually says, and God created the great crocodiles and every living creature that moves. This is the soul of animal life, the creation here. Verse 21 of chapter 1. The Hebrew, of course, doesn't talk like that. It says, "And v'yivra Elohim et ha'taninim ha'gedolim," and God created the big taninim. Taninim is a difficult word. What's a tanin? We don't know. Like many of these words, we are very difficult. You don't get from context. So it says, "And God created the big tanin." Now it's translated as the big crocodiles. So I want to know what tanin means. So I go and I read where it appears elsewhere in the Torah. Moses appears before Pharaoh, right? He's got a big deal and he's got a big charge. He's got a big problem. He's got to get the people out of Egypt. God has set Moses up with a few wonder tricks to show, right? One of them is a stick he carries with him, right? A rod. And when he throws the rod down on the ground, what does it become? A snake. What class of animals does a snake belong to? Reptiles. God throws his stick down and it becomes a nahash, which is the specific word for a type of reptile we call a snake. The Hebrew word nahash. Moses throws the stick down and becomes a nahash. Moses throws the stick down another time, the same stick, and he's still in the wonder show with Pharaoh, and he throws it down, and what does the stick become? A snake again. But now a different word is used. It's called a tanin. See, tanin is the generic word for reptile. Because the Torah only talks about reptiles, it doesn't talk about crocodiles, but reptiles. When the stick goes, but we now understand from the specific term that once it's called a nachash, a snake, and it was always a snake both times, that tanin is the generic term for reptile. Now I go back to the book and I say, Hannah, look at this. Can you believe it? Genesis chapter 1, verse 21. And God created the great reptiles. Gedolim, the big reptiles is a better one. And God created the big reptiles. Anyone know what class dinosaurs belong to? What are the biggest animals that have ever existed on Earth? I'll give you a hint, it's not the whales. What are the biggest animals? Which? No? The dinosaurs. And God created the big reptiles. Big is attributed to only one word of all the animals and all the plants, the taninim. And there it is, the big reptiles. Hannah's got an answer now, not only for how old they were, but also that they existed. What are the big reptiles in the world? They don't exist any longer except in the museum down the road. The dinosaurs. There's no problem, Hannah. The dinosaurs are there, age-wise and also in form, the big reptiles. That's it. If there are questions, I'll answer a few questions. Yeah.
What's the time span in one cell life?
One cell life goes about 80% of the time that life has appeared on Earth. From the beginning.
In terms of time span and in terms of biblical time span.
Well, this would be day three. It's day three, but it's about 4 billion years ago. That's when the Earth appears. This would be all of day. Let me just think. What's going on here? I have to think. The Earth becomes oxic. That takes a few billion years. So we're getting here. Oh, this is day five. Day five is where the change starts to occur.
Okay.
Because day three and day four are included in these 3 billion years because you have the Earth becoming oxic. During day four, in my understanding, I talk about in Genesis of the Big Bang, the atmosphere becomes oxic. How do I know that? Because it doesn't say that God created the sun on the fourth day. It says that the sun becomes visible on the fourth day. And the sun would not be visible through an anoxic atmosphere. The atmosphere would be translucent, not transparent. The light would come through enough to power the plants, photosynthesis, but not the globe of the sun. We know that from what? From the atmosphere of Venus. Venus has a primitive atmosphere similar to what we may have had. It's all speculation because no one is certain, but all the data indicate that our atmosphere is similar to what Venus was once like. That atmosphere is translucent but not transparent. Now, it's a much thicker atmosphere than we're talking about here. I want to make that clear. I'm just talking about the transparency of it.
So that goes up to day...
That goes up to about 560 million years ago, and that's day three and day four. On day five, we have multicellular life appear. Which is what the Torah talks about, big, you know, aquatic animals. Those are the first multicellular plants. And we have plants also, the communities of plants. What's that, 560 million years, half a billion years ago. 560 million years ago.
Million.
Yeah, a million, sure, 560 million. It's a half a billion.
So there were plants on the earth.
Huh?
There were plants on the earth.
Oh, well, it's the difficulty with the Torah. You have to understand that the Torah has a format and how it works. I think we mentioned this before the class. The Torah deals with the topic and in its totality. So if it says on the third day that plants and trees, it's talking about plant life beginning, the seeds of life for plant life. It doesn't then say that on the third day certain types of plants, and then the fourth day other types, and fifth day. The Torah only deals generically except for humans. Okay? So it includes all the plants on the third day. That in no way implies that all the plants appeared in that third day. How do we learn that? We can learn that very explicitly from Abraham in the very end of the portion that we read Noah. It's called the Bible portions. The Bible is broken up into portions. At the end of Noah, it says that Abraham left his father. And at the end of Noah, it says that Abraham's father died. Okay? In the very next two sentences later, it says that Abraham's father was Terach. Abraham's father died. And then it says Abraham left to go on to Canaan. This is Abraham leaving, okay? This won't make sense until I fill us the whole story. We can tell from the Bible, very simple reading it, you can get it totally out of the English, that Abraham's father lived 60 years after Abraham left. But what we have in the Torah is the following. Abraham leaves his father, Abraham's father dies, and Abraham goes on to Canaan. Why doesn't the Torah then say later, and Abraham's father died? Because the Torah deals with certain events and wants to get rid of, you know, finish them. Abraham's father, you know, that was enough. So it finishes the account of the father of Abraham and says he dies, even though it's not chronologically correct according to the verses, because it wants to finish with it. When it says on the third day plants were formed, and then it says all these different kinds of plants and fruit trees, it wants to finish with plants, because the big story in the Torah isn't plants. It's us, animals. So it finishes with its story on plants, even though all those plants weren't created on the third day necessarily. Do you get the point I'm saying? The basis was there. The basis was there, and then that developed over time.
Since we first Genesis 1, verse 2, with the spearhead, right? Can you find it?
Yeah, and the Spirit of God hovered on the face of the moon. Genesis chapter 1, verse 2. It says, the wind of God moved over. Oh, yeah, but the Hebrew is not that at all. It's a real problem. Ruach means spirit. It also means wind, you know.
Wind.
Yeah, which means spirit. See, it says Ruach Elohim. The Hebrew is Ruach Elohim Mirachefet, and God. And it doesn't mean move. Mirachefet, which is the Hebrew, is it only appears one other place. It's like what an eagle does over its nest. It's like this, hovers. It doesn't move. Its wing. It holds. You know how you ever see a bird over its nest? It doesn't. It stands still as it moves its wings. The Hebrew is, and the exact Hebrew is, and the Spirit of God hovered over the face of the universe. Whatever that means, I can. I don't know.
You know the Egyptians wrote at this time.
I beg your pardon?
The Egyptians wrote at this time.
Oh yeah, they were hieroglyphics.
Was there any history on the sea, on the army being drowned?
As far as I know, no. But then there's no record of any of their defeats. And we know they were defeated because the Hyksos took them over. They have a very big eraser in the Egyptian community. It's called a chisel. I'm saying, seriously. They still do, yeah. Yeah, no, so they don't include any of that. Yet we know that the Hyksos took over. There's no, you know, it's very hard to find a record of that. It was the Hyksos that apparently were in power when the Exodus took place. That's why it says about Joseph, when Potiphar's wife says, look, he brought us a Hebrew. Potiphar's wife was apparently an Egyptian, and her husband was a foreign ruler, Hyksos. So she talks very disparagingly to the servant. She says, look, he brought a Hebrew servant, he being her husband, an Egyptian, Hyksos. Yeah. Shoot. Yeah. You can. There's no link. There are no fossil. I am not an expert in the fossil. I want to make it very clear. I'm only reading now what I read in the literature, in the scientific literature, not your theological literature. That there is no. Come, the class is over. They're having a question. Answer. We're having questions and answers now. The data are missing. There are no fossils, and major paleontologists say they will never be found because the record is so. I'm so sorry to make a note of that, but one of the really leading agnostic fossil people says we're never going to find these more because the record is too complete. It's not like we're going to suddenly find a whole find. They aren't there. Now we have to develop a theory, which they've developed. which accounts for this. You can always develop a theory which accounts for it. It's not a difficulty. The theory is based on what's called genetic bottlenecks. Most of the animals die off, a few remain, and those mutate. So you don't have the population problem.